This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. When it comes to sports, Nicholas Davidoff is more of a baseball guy. He's written about it, and why not? It's a sport that lends itself well to literary prose. Football, not so much. Which may be why he decided to make that the subject of his latest book. He wanted to find the story in what otherwise looks like just bone-crushing mayhem. So Nicholas embedded himself with the New York Jets for a year and came back with his new book, Collision Low Crossers, a year inside the turbulent world of NFL football. He's going to be at the Regulator Bookshop on Monday, but first Nicholas Davidoff joins us to talk about the new book. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
I need to ask you what collision low crossers are. Because I looked at that and said, I don't remember hearing that.
Well, lots of people follow this game. Football is the single most popular entertainment in the United States by a lot. And I guess I wanted a title that would signal what, to me, was one of the curious things about football, which is that it's so amazingly popular. And yet, with the exception of those one-hour-on-the-clock games every Sunday or Thursday and sometimes Monday, most of the NFL life takes place at NFL facilities. And that leaves close to 365 days a year in which everything is obscured from people. And Collision Low Crossers is, to me, an example of that. And what it means is that it's permissible to make legal contact with potential pass receivers who are crossing the field within 5 yards of the line of scrimmage. Beyond 5 yards, it's a penalty. And I guess I liked it as a title both because, I like titles like Full Metal Jacket or Zero Dark Thirty, which suggest that there's something much more compelling and interesting than you know about something that you already thought you knew all about. But I also liked it because it suggests so much about the game. In other words, it's challenging to collision a low crosser. The receiver knows where he's going, and the person who wants to knock him off course doesn't. But it also suggests something to me, which are the basic elements of football, which are speed, aggression, the interplay between space and time, and plans that aren't likely to come to fruition. It's the essential calamity of what goes on out there. There's always someone out there waiting to ruin your life in a way.
And as you point out, the essence of the game is this kind of violence and the sense of that your plan might not work out. But the plans are the important part. And I think it's important to point out that, and as you do in the book, according to the contract that the NFL players have, they can have 14 practices a year in a 17-game season, regular season, where there's actual pads and contact. So whatever we thought they were doing during the week, it ain't hitting each other. They're sitting in classrooms looking at film and reading very, very thick, books on what the next team is going to do.
Yeah, I thought of the Jets facility as sort of the Institute for Advanced Football Studies. And Princeton's not that far away. And I guess I also thought that you're right. I mean, many things that surprised me about pro football is that there's even in those padded practices, there's no tackling because it's too dangerous. What so much surprised me about the sport and what I was really drawn to is how much of the sport really takes place off the field. The practices are a tiny fraction of what goes into the football life. And while I spent time with the players, the people who are spending the most time and the most engaged in what you might call the process of football are the coaching staffs. So I began my mornings by spending there's a 50-minute quarterbacks meeting every morning at the beginning of the morning. And after that, I spent day into evening into night with the defensive coaches and was sort of – I just sat there and listened and tried to understand terms like collision low crossers.
And personalities and the way personalities play against each other is an important part. And I think one of the more surprising elements in your book, just how much that socialization plays a part in developing a team.
That's right. From the first day of training camp, the Jets, very charismatic and within the structure of football, I know he's controversial outside it, but within a football team, he is just beloved and admired. Rex Ryan gets up in front of his team and he has these long, what I found really, really appealing riffs on what composes a football team. And he would say, we've got big guys and we've got small guys. We've got handsome guys and we've got a lot of ugly guys. And it would just go on and on with these comparisons. And in effect, he was telling you that a football team is composed of a little bit of everyone. And it's really true. The huddle is in effect America. And, he would say, you don't have to like everybody. You're not going to like everybody. But when you're here, you have to respect everybody and you have to build everybody up. It's a team sport. It's the ultimate team sport. And these riffs would go on and on. And he really was a master motivator. elevator. And right from the beginning, this was really stressed, which, of course, you're thinking that this is somewhat in contrast to what you've heard coming out of Miami. And in my experience, you know, that really was true, that he made it a point right from the beginning that there had to be unity. Of course, and that's really an essential thing in the NFL if you think about it, because for players and coaches both, it's such a transient and ephemeral existence. People are joining teams, leaving teams. Many players are with a team one day and then they're out on the street the next. There's a ruthlessness to pro football. And how do you make, given the ruthlessness of that particular aspect of the culture, how do you make a unified team in which people are willing to sort of sacrifice some aspects of individual accomplishment for the greater collective good? And one way you do it is by having a coach like Rex Ryan, who is very, very engaged with this
problem. Well, not everybody, they all make that speech, but not everybody believes it. So the reference to Miami is actually a racially tinged bullying episode that results in one player being suspended, another leaving. When you think about bullying being a problem in football, it's almost comic, right? Like, why isn't everybody a bully on a football team? And yet, on this particular team, the Miami Dolphins, it really became a serious issue for that team and kind of broke it apart. So what's the difference? Where's the line between that good-natured ribbing that has to be part of that locker room, right, and bullying, and something that is so divisive it breaks a team apart?
Right. Well, you know, in certain ways, I think of this almost as not a football book, but an office book per se, because the way football coaches interact with one another and then interact with the larger team is so much like any other really intensely committed, intensely fulfilling occupation where a bunch of people are working in close concert together at some very difficult, elusive task. And I'd say that the rules in any sort of office situation apply to football, too. I don't think that everybody in football is potentially a bully. I think that I saw every kind of person. They're fascinating people within football, and that was one of the things that made it so much fun to write about. They're real characters there. And yes, there's teasing just as there is at any office space, but I think it's pretty intuitive when teasing is affectionate or when it's intended to hurt somebody, when it's mean-spirited or cruel, or when it expresses some sort of awkward power dynamic. And I can tell you that from my own experience, from the moment I got there, I was different. And of course, it's essential that there be a culture of conformity for a football team because, you know, everybody's wearing the same colors and everybody's after the same goal. And I was different. You know, it's an SUV culture. I drove a Mini Cooper. At lunch, I would sit with the coaches and players, and there was a lot of brown stuff being consumed, and I was the guy who liked beet salads. And when I exercised, I wore a purple headband, a bandana. It seemed pretty innocuous to me, but I was pulled aside by the guy who was running the draft for the team, and he said, in front of a whole bunch of other people, Nikki, you know, their headband concerns. And I loved all that. I mean, you know, and they could tell that I loved it. I mean, I really liked being teased, and I thought that they were funny, and I could tell that it was affectionate, and it made me enjoy them more and understand that aspect of the culture. But then there were times in the quarterbacks meetings at the beginning of the day when I arrived before the Baltimore Ravens game for the last quarterbacks meeting. And they welcomed me into the meeting, and they said, "Hookworm." And I said, "Hookworm?" And they said, "Bookworm, bookworm." You know. Uh-huh. And then they immediately shortened it to worm. Nobody wants to be called worm. And, you know, it was funny for a moment. But then, you know, I was a guy in my 40s, you know. I had kids at home, you know. And to come into work very early on 3 or 4 hours sleep, which is that crazy football life, and to hear this. And they, you know, I understood that if they were going to lose games and I was going to watch them, I should suffer something too. I understood that I was different. I understood and was grateful that they were showing me in this privileged way the culture. But after a while, I could have a little bit done without it. And yet, as I thought about it, this was another little insight into this particular aspect of the culture that we're talking about right now, because I could see how something that was an annoyance to me could almost casually devolve for someone else into something that was really, really complicated and hurtful and would take them a little bit off course in what they're doing. Because football teams work really, really hard. It is an immersive 7-day-a-week occupation. And if you dread in any way coming into work, that's a terrible thing because you work to the exclusion of everything else. I mean, coaches anyway, they lose their, you know, so much of their children's growing up, they lose, many of them become divorced, they lose their marriages. There was one coach who told me he was in his 60s that he hoped to play golf and he never had because there's never been time. You know, it is a completely immersive profession. And if you have that you know, if you have that as your sole aspect of your existence and somebody's making it painful for you to be around, even in a small way, quickly it can become, I would think, overwhelming.
Yeah, but what you point out in the book, I think, is the kind of social architecture within football teams that makes that work. In other words, the difference between what happens in Miami and other places. I heard one analyst who had played football for a long time, who was mixed race, talk about saying, yeah, I've heard those terms all the time in the locker room, but whenever it got out of control, there was always a leader in that locker room who would make it stop or take it to the coaches. Apparently, that didn't happen in Miami. The clear suggestion is there is a social hierarchy here that keeps these teams together, and it might not be anything we recognize in the office, although we have our own. But that must have been something that you saw and saw at work, and how that really kept teams and also kept guys coming back to a very dangerous sport, which, you know, when they're one play away from the end of their career.
Oh, yeah. Football is full of hierarchy and stratification and status. I remember the day I learned the term Roys, and I wanted to know what Roys meant, and it was out on the practice field, and the coach who used it told me, well, you know, they're the starters and the guys who are going to play, and then they're the Roys, the rest of y'alls. on the team flights to games, you can tell who has the highest status just by where they're sitting on the flight. I was in the back of the flight.
Well, that's because
headband. You know, no headbands on the flight. You have to wear your dress sweats, according to Rex Ryan. But you know, after these stories came out of Miami, I, you know, got in touch with some of the older Jets players who were now retired, but who'd been on the team, and I asked them about this, and they were all horrified too, and they said that this never could have happened because they'd never seen anything like it, and it never could have happened because veteran Jets players never would have let it happen. And that's one reason they like playing for Rex, because his principles were their principles. It really was a pretty – there's every kind of person, and of course you enjoy some people more than other people, but for me, by and large, except after terrible losses when there's incredible depression and frustration, by and large, it was a pretty affectionate group of people.
How did they deal with the potential injury? I mean, we're hearing more and more about traumatic brain injury. Nobody gets out of that sport, you know, without a concussion, and now we know how damaging they are. What do the players do in the face of that? We're seeing more and more. One player has just plain walked away, but it's only one. How do they deal with that the potential?
Well, Rex Ryan always says that football, you know, you have to be incredibly brave to play football. It has an 100% injury rate, and also I think – you know, that he would say that one thing he would say that the players aren't a piece of meat to me, and he often doesn't let players play when they want to play because he thinks that they're too hurt. That points to a little bit to a shift in the culture of the game, because his father, Buddy Ryan, who was a famous coach, never would have gone for that. I think in general, you know, when I would be out in my real life, out in the world, that's all people wanted to talk to me about were concussions. But within the culture of football, within the facility culture, nobody talked about it unless I brought it up. And the reason nobody talked about it is because when you get onto a football field, they call it the switch. Once you turn that switch on, you have to be prepared to do something which is risky and very dangerous. And it's also blurry fast. And you can't do that if you're worried about getting hurt. Now, everybody's walked onto a football field at some point and felt a little fear. But by and large, you're not going to be successful at football if you think you're going to get a concussion. So they don't talk about it. I think also within the realm of players and coaches, it's true that the job of playing professional football is so consuming that if you're thinking about, you know, how should we better legislate concussions and so forth, there's just no time for this. So that, you know, I'd say that's a form of gravitas, which they just leave to the experts. So they leave it to medical experts, they leave it to the league, and whenever new rules come in, they just accept them and they go forward, although some of the older coaches don't accept them. I mean, they abide them, but they don't accept them. They think that football is getting too, as they would put it, soft. But the final thing that I would say about all this is that some of the younger players talked about how right sort of within their careers they've seen a distinct and a signal change. And that change is if you went to the training room when they were just starting out, you were thought to be soft, and so they would stay away from the training room. Now they feel it's much more professional. Everybody recognizes that the injuries are just they're bad for everyone. And while you have to be able to play with a certain amount of pain, it's nonetheless true that the healthier you are, the better the team is. So there's a real pressure now, at least there was in the Jets facility, to make sure that you get good health care.
Have you talked to war correspondents and kind of compared notes about the culture of, sort of battle-hardened soldiers and football players?
It's an interesting question. There are two members of the Jets coaching staff who I love to talk with about this very issue. One was Bob Sutton, who for many, many years was the highly successful coach at West Point. And one of his former players, Ben Kotwika, was someone who flew Apache helicopter missions in Iraq. And I spoke, and Bob was really immersed in sort of the relationship between the culture of battle and the culture of football. And both of them would immediately emphasize that, you know, one is a game and one is war, and that you really shouldn't talk about the two in, you know, in the same way. But of course, there are within an organizational structure, there are many, things that are consistent. And certainly a lot of it is hierarchy. But I think the thing that was most interesting to me that they would talk about in one in relation to the other had to do with why players played and why soldiers fight. And they said that it was really often quite the same thing. You're not playing for your fans. Sorry. You're not even playing necessarily for the money. What you're really playing for and what you're putting yourself out there for your teammates in the same way that soldiers are putting themselves out there for their comrades. And that is an intensely appealing thing for football players. And one of the things it redounds to is something I learned about why a lot of people who play football are drawn to it. A large majority of football players, well, I shouldn't say a large majority, a large segment of football players come from difficult backgrounds. This involves many single-parent families. There's some of the players are orphans. Many of them grew up in really serious poverty. And they say that they get from football things that they didn't have during their childhoods. And football players, for the most part, are still very, very young. And they said that more than the money and more even than the pleasure in the game, the greatest pleasure for them is in the camaraderie, but also in the ability to have surrogate brothers, surrogate uncles. And one player and I had a long conversation about this, and he told me, football is my father. And I found that, you know, really, really moving. I mean, we think of football as a violent, aggressive, chaotic game. But to me, there was so much about it that was both moving and also just interesting in ways that maybe I had only thought that baseball was interesting. I mean, we talked at the beginning about the relationship between baseball and writing, and that has a lot to do with pace and that football's too fast, so it becomes this sort of unseeable blur. But the essence of football really is the planning. And as I sat week after week, night after night with those coaches watching them plan a season and then plan each game, I saw that this is their act of creation, that a great deal of imagination and thought goes into it. And I felt both in terms of the pace but also in the burning frustration of trying to perfect something that can never be perfected, trying to control the uncontrollable, that this was really their version of an artistic endeavor. And it, to me, it felt a little bit like writing.
That is obviously a kind of revelation to you. Is that your biggest surprise, or what was the biggest surprise for you in your year with the Jets?
You know, because it's such a mysterious culture, and because, as the coach has always said, I wasn't a football guy, you know, it's a purple headband guy or something. Yeah. You know, it was littered with surprises for me. I didn't know that they didn't tackle in practice. One big surprise, for example, is how much failure is involved. There only 10% of the time do plays work. And by that I mean, do all 11 players do exactly what they're supposed to do on the diagram? And that points not at all to any particular liability in football players. It points to the very intricate choreography of football plays. It also points to something else, which I never would have known, which is that, you know, what coaches have to bring, they don't play. What they have to bring is they have a form of anticipation. They can look at the design of another team, and they can analyze it and break it down and see what another team does well. And then in the days coming up to that particular game, they can devise stratagems to overcome what the other team does well. But there are only so – and they could do it for, you know, 50 or 60 different potential plays. But there's only so much football there are only so many football diagrams and football instructions that can be absorbed by the players in that short an amount of time. And so one of the signal tensions in football is, do you overload players with information and that slows them down because it's such a reactive, fast-paced game? Or do you restrain yourself and just do a few things that you do really well?
Let them play. The other reason for all the failure, Nicholas, is that you were covering the Jets. I'm sorry. Forgive me. Forgive me, Nicholas. Nicholas Davidoff is the author.
Cruel.
It was terrible, right? But that's
vicious.
Hey, there's next year.
You wouldn't do well in a locker room.
Nicholas Davidoff, the author of Collision Low Crossers, A Year Inside the Turbulent World of NFL Football. Stay with us on The State of Things.